What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Yana Byers, and I'm here today with Sarah Ritchie, Associate Professor of History at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, Tennessee, about her new book, Acts of Care, Recovering Women in Late Medieval Health, out with Cornell University Press this year, 2021. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
You are so welcome. Thanks for joining me. Oh, how are you? How are things in Knoxville?
Things are great. I'm actually talking to you right now from Washington, D.C., but I'm still teaching this semester, and so I'm kind of back and forth between Knoxville virtually and D.C. physically, but things are going as good as could possibly be expected. I consider myself very lucky to be healthy and here talking with you.
Yep, that is that's the thing. When we want to despair, we must remember that this is actually okay.
Yeah,
we're actually doing okay. We're still kind of over it though.
Yeah, I'm getting pretty tired of it. Sure, definitely. I've learned so much about myself, about my family, my work habits, my needs, and now I know I'm done learning about myself.
Yeah, absolutely. I suspected that I would never take off my yoga pants, and I was right, and that'll
do. I am the person too.
All right. Okay, so I'm looking over your CV, and I see some very clear academic interests. You know, as well as your first monograph, Gender, Health, and Healing, 1250 to 1550, you've written several of these articles with these really fabulous titles, like Caring by the Hours, The Psalter is a Source of Gendered Healthcare, Health, Healing, and Salvation, Hagiography is a Source of Medieval Healthcare, The Wounds, Presence, and Bodily Absence, The Experience of God in a 14th Century Manuscript, all of which show a clear kind of relentless interest in the intersection of religious practice, writ large, and the practice of medicine, writ equally large, in the medieval era. So I'd like to know kind of how this happened. How did you come to these interests? How did you begin to look for healthcare kind of in this space? How did you come to write this book in general?
Yeah. Okay, great. That's a great question. Thank you so much. I should say Gender, Health, and Healing is, just for clarification, is not my monograph. That's actually an edited volume. And the reason it's so important for me to say that is because Sharon Strokia, my co-editor, is so brilliant. And I know she's been on your show. And all of the collaborators, all of the authors that participated in that volume have just been so just brilliant to work with.
Oh, yeah.
So I just wanted to make sure that I clarified that. My first monograph came out in 2014 on Cornell Press, and it's called Holy Matter. A long subtitle, and sometimes I can't even remember what it is. Changing Perceptions of the Material World.
Christianity. Thanks. I'm sorry. I just wrote copied the wrong line of the CV on
it's totally understandable. So I came, but nevertheless, the question still, it's a great question, and it makes a lot of sense because there is so much, there's so much overlap in these ideas about religion and medicine that I've been exploring for my entire career. And I think even with holy matter, questions about the material world and the immaterial world, or the visible world and the invisible world, really were coming together. So to get back to your question about how I came to this, I, like so many of these big long-term projects, I think it came in a number of waves. And so I started really thinking about this project, probably in 2009, which was a really pivotal year for me. I was still actually working on my first book. And that was the year I had my son. I delivered my son, and my mother-in-law was also extremely ill and eventually died. And it was a very difficult time in that sense, but also a very joyful time in the sense of the birth of our son. And so I was spending a lot of time in hospitals, just a sort of an extraordinary amount of time in hospitals. And I was also navigating with great intensity the broken healthcare system that is in this country. And at the same time, I'm from South Louisiana. And I was, at the time, I was working there at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, and I was surrounded by my family, who has been there for generations and generations. And so I was sort of immersed in these Cajun and Creole traditions of healing and caring, traditions surrounding birth and death, and food as a form of caring. And so I think that I was at that moment, that really pivotal moment in my life, where I really began to see for the first time what was always there surrounding me. Jessica Marie Johnson introduced me to this term, submerged knowledge. And so I think it was at that time, surrounded by family, by caretakers of many varieties, that I started to see everyday acts as a form of submerged knowledge about the body and about what works for healing in terms of healing and caring. I was also, I should say, I was at the same time that semester, I was teaching the Liegeois corpus as part of a course on gender and mysticism in the Middle Ages. And so as I was kind of going through these these daily acts of care, I was being cared for. I was giving a lot of care in my life. I was also teaching that what would become sort of the first source base for this project, being able to see in those I was starting to see the patterns that were becoming visible in my own life were becoming visible in the sources that I was teaching as well. And I would also add, so that was one sort of moment of the genesis of this project. But I would be remiss not to add the other extremely pivotal moment, which was in 2012. I was lucky enough to take part in the NEH Summer Institute led by Monica Green, the Wellcome Institute in London. And that's when what was previously sort of a feeling became an actual viable project because of Monica's ability to introduce me to a whole range of manuscripts and historiographies and interlocutors and a network of scholars. So I think that was the sort of the next big step. And then the project kind of just unfolded from there.
Mm-hmm. All right. This makes sense, you know, that you would, in the medieval world, like the walls between the physical and the spiritual worlds are just so porous, right? And then, you know, that you would have this experience where you're seeing them this way as well. You're having these intense physical and emotional experiences. And it makes sense that this would kind of come together and coalesce for you into a project. Yeah. And the idea of submerged knowledge, which leads us kind of to your sources. because there are loads of pre-modern medical treatises out there, and that's not what you use primarily. So I would like you to tell our listeners what you are using and why you've picked that.
Oh, gosh, yeah. So my sources are a little bit all over the place, really. It's kind of a grab bag. One of the sort of challenges of this project was figuring out how to organize it. I think I wrote it and then rewrote it. I don't even want to say how many times, based on sort of reorganizing it based on sources. And so, we ended up deciding, and I mean we, as in me and all of the immense amount of scholars and editors that really helped me think through it. I ended up, with that help, dividing it into three sections based on sources. So I guess I could kind of walk you through the book, talking about those, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Like we can.
I don't want to look at it that way. Again.
Yeah. No. That's how we can do this. That's great.
Okay. So the first, as I mentioned before, the sort of first set of sources is the first part of the book, and those are hagiographic sources. So in the Low Countries, in the 13th century, there is this body of saints' lives, this really rich, sort of unequaled body of narrative texts that tells us about holy people who were, developed, attracted cults, attracted communities of the faithful while they were still alive. And so those are just incredible sources to begin with. And in particularly in terms of gender, they're helpful for thinking about sanctity and how sanctity manifested along the lines of gender, because they because it's kind of easy to divide them between easily between women and men. Okay, so the first set of sources then is primarily hagiographic. I start with miracle stories that took place at tombs and with relics of women saints from the 13th century Low Countries. And I should say that women and 13th century and Low Countries, all of these things can be qualified here, but that's what the monograph is for and not for a podcast. So I'm just going to
get over that.
But roughly speaking, in this time, in this place, stories about miraculous, posthumous healing were told about women and not about men.
Okay.
So that's where I start. And again, there are some qualifications. We can argue about sample size. We can argue about what is a miracle, what is a saint, what is a cure, but that's not even really remotely the point. The point is that there is a gendered dimension to these stories, and that's what I wanted to investigate. I wanted to ask, why were stories about health and care and cure attributed to women in this in place, especially since, and this I think is really getting to the question that you're asking. If we look at the documents, if we look at the treatises from the so-called medical tradition, women aren't credited as healers. Mm-hmm. So why is there such a proliferation of attention to women as healers in these kinds of sources? So well, I also, go ahead.
Well, I think it's interesting to note as well that, you know, if we think about, they are so, so interested in cure and care that if you read them and you tend to take that almost for granted, you can anyway, but we could think about as well, the wide variety of things that these tales, these saints' lives could be talking about, but they really do focus on healthcare, right?
Oh, and
you know, that like this is it, there's so much that isn't there in so that they can be about healthcare. And then if you compare that with medical treatises, and I'm making air quotes, where there are no women at all, it's really striking.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It is the space, it is the sort of narrative space that allows us to see what women were doing. One of the sort of anecdotes that really speaks to me. And I think I start the book with this, but I'm going to be honest with you and tell you that once I see something in print that I've written, I cannot look at it again. So I can't remember if it's the beginning.
Understood.
Chapter, or if it's the beginning of the book itself, I can't remember. But anyway, one of the stories that was really just kind of eye popping for me was Ida of Louvain, her hagiographer tells this sort of extended, detailed story about her going into the home of a man who was suffering. I can't remember exactly what his affliction was, but I believe that was something like a tumor of some kind. It's all described. She asks questions about the site of the pain and the time, the duration of the pain. And then she, sort of with a look, she lances it and he's fine. He's on his deathbed and then he's fine. And so all of this is happening. And these are, that component is fairly typical, but then the hagiographer says, and from this moment forward, everyone revered her for her virginal holiness. And I was like, but wait, she just healed someone. What does this have to do with her virginal holiness? And so it really helped me clarify how stories about religious women were healing stories about religious women transmitted through, and they were translated through narratives of holiness, narratives of sort of virginity, brides of Christ language.
Mm-hmm. And where power comes from, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Right. Where, from whence these women's authority comes. So is this a good time to talk about the idea of non-evidence?
Every time is a good time. If you have let me know if you have a specific question. I will just say that is Monica Green's genius term, non-evidence. And you know, for me, what non-evidence means is, I mean, I think the main thing that I want to get across when talking about non-evidence is not, it's not even really, it's not novel. It's not even mine. And it's really a methodological argument. It's one that medievalists of color have been making for some time. Mm-hmm. It's certainly beyond the world of medieval studies, scholars in Native American and Indigenous studies and African American history, histories of enslavement, Black feminist scholars, scholars of empire. They've all been telling us, they've all been showing us that what gets recorded in the archive is not the whole story. There are lives and knowledges and experiences and kinship formations and strategies of survival that have evaded the archive, that have been intentionally dismissed as evidence over hundreds of years. So that's what non-evidence is to me. Non-evidence is exactly like you say, it's about power. It's about what gets recorded as knowledge, as truth. What we as historians say, okay, that's knowledge, that's evidence. It's on us too.
Yeah, that's a very important point. It's what's written down originally, what is retold, what gets put where in an archive whenever that happens, you know, which can be the 14th century or last week. And then what we talk about, there's kind of this ongoing thing. So all of these, your source material, these hagiographical texts, they're largely a lot of women talking or being talked about, right? Mm-hmm. And so what does this tell us about religious women's acts of care? The power and authority they hold over sick bodies is a question you bring up.
Yeah. I think in part it tells us, it tells us a lot of things. One is that feminized forms of care were indeed valued. They were indeed integral to healthcare, the pre-modern healthcare system, at least in Western Europe, in a way that is not reflected in our sources. That is, in a way that is not reflected in our sources that we have heretofore reckoned as medical. So that's one thing I think that they tell us. I think another thing that these sources tell us about women's care is that that what was valued about women's care seems to have been especially their affective labor. So when we look at these sources, we see all kinds of different kinds of care, wound care, obstetric care, the healing, or not necessarily healing, I want to be careful with that term, but caring for people with leprosy, caring for people with all kinds of afflictions. But even though there's this huge range of the kinds of healthcare acts that we see in these sources, the one thing that seems to be an absolute constant is this interest in attending to or calling upon women at times of dire need, intense sickness, nearing death, calling women to be by the bedside to provide forms of affective care, including prayers, the recitation of the Psalms, I talk quite a bit at some point about the sort of highly dramatic poetry that seems to have been recited for the sick in the presence of the sick. So to kind of wrap up your question, all of the kinds of care, to use the medical terminology of the time, the non-naturals, this kind of gets us into the weeds a little bit. I don't know if you can just stop me now.
Go ahead and do this. The non-naturals. This is fascinating.
But the humoral body, the pre-modern humoral body, was to kind of project this in the most generalized terms possible. The body itself, the internal body, was made up of humors and qualities, that determined the balance of the humors or the imbalance of them determined a patient's sickness or health. What kind of remedies they might need, but what were called the non-naturals referred to they're called the six non-naturals, and this refers to factors external to the body that influence, that affect the internal body. So you can think of things like the quality of the air as external to the body. But nevertheless, you could see how in a medieval humoral system, the air that you breathe would, of course, affect the interior of the body, or something like exercise. These are non-naturals. But one of the other non-naturals, one of the six non-naturals, is something, it's variously termed, but it's the passions of the soul. This really just dramatic word for a phrase for what we might now think of it as the emotions. So emotional health was incredibly important, incredibly vital to human health more generally. And it seems from these sources that care of emotional health was something that doctors of all kinds, of all varieties, did take care of, but religious women seemed to be regarded as experts in caring for the passions of the soul through things like prayers and intense words, dramatic performances, poetry, music, liturgy.
All right. There's so many ways I want to go right now. And we're a little off script for me, so, We may have to come back. No, it's because this is so cool. And I just want to make a quick note for my listeners, for anyone who's not a medievalist or, you know, a pre-modern historian, that this isn't far off from what we talk about now, right? We have this idea that medieval medicine is hideous and, you know, it's not great, but the idea that your emotional health matters is something that people are still going to talk about. It's not bad, you know?
Right.
I feel like I want to put that in, you know, because our students are always like, well, it's lucky anyone lived. And it's like, well, kind of. There were no antibiotics. But the idea that you should keep a wound clean is pretty solid. Okay. So I think that what I want to do now is go into part two, where you move to sources that are largely written by authorities, male authorities.
Go ahead.
No, there we go. You're okay. Off. Go.
All right. So yeah, so part two, and I have to say, just to get back to the issue of how on earth one writes or organizes a book, this part was such a challenge for me, and everyone that I gave it to read was like, I don't know what you do with this. But originally it was the last part of the book, and pretty much universally everyone was like, no, you cannot end your book on these male authoritative sources after everything that you've said. So that's how it became the second part of the book. So again, the book is structured by source material. And so the second part of the book is these authoritative texts. They are male authored texts. And they are texts about therapeutic knowledge and therapeutic authority. So there are a number of overlapping discourses, overlapping conversations, authoritative conversations, that talk about how bodies heal and very importantly, who has the authority to use the tools that enable bodies to heal. So there are medical discourses, there are medical texts. In medical texts, male authored, when I'm saying medical texts here, I mean very much like physician authored, university trained medical texts, treatises, systematic treatises on medicine. Mm-hmm. And these texts make plenty of room for the passions of the soul. They make plenty of room for the kinds of caregiving and health providing acts that we have seen in the first section that we've already talked about, that women were responsible for, the caring for the non-natural environment, caring for, just basic emotional health, but additionally, your basic everyday regimen. But food, providing healthy food, a healthy, clean environment, this sort of thing. So they make plenty of room for that. What they're sort of the ground, I guess you could say that there is some anxiety among mm-hmm. all of these authoritative discourses when it comes to the passions of the soul and when it comes to what we might think of as verbal forms of medicine. So prayers, charms or incantations, which are, I can see why your listeners might not know what I mean by a charm or an incantation.
Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah.
These are just words, really. They can mm-hmm. be written words. They can be performed words. They're sort of utterances. Or written down, in that case, not necessarily utterances, but they're words that are prescribed for healing purposes. The authoritative medical treatises seem to have a lot of anxiety about, they certainly say, they're not willing to say that these do not work, but instead they want to, these male authors, university-trained authors, really want to kind of take control over the circumstances mm-hmm. in which verbal medicine can work. And those circumstances to generalize are masculine. Only men, they want to state that it is only trained men, trained physicians, who can properly use these words and harness these words. So on the one hand, yeah, there's a lot of discourse, kind of trying to figure out the terms on which herbal medicine is able to be used. That's one aspect. There's also, at the same time, there's anxiety about from another terrain of authority among theologians and hagiographers. There's anxiety about the place of the soul. There's anxiety about perhaps there's a recognition, of course, that the physica, that scientific medicine, material-based, rational-based medicine is very, very important. But there is some concern we notice in the conversations among authoritative theologians and hagiographers about the place of the soul. Like, there's some concern that maybe there's too much physicalization, there's too much rationalization, and maybe the place of God and miracle is being eroded by medical discourses. So basically, that the whole section two is of the book is about the anxiety over therapeutic authority, about who can heal, what are the terms on which they can heal. And it's if I could have written it the way I wanted it to write it, it would have been just a head spinning, overlapping crosstalk about God and the body and science and the 13th century. But you keep running into our academic models of writing that simply don't allow for that kind of messiness. That's basically what's going on in that chapter.
Well, I mean, that's kind of diving into that messiness, like getting into the fray of those words and then coming back out and explaining it to other people. And meaning that's kind of our job, right?
Right. Yeah.
Like, here, let me do this incredibly heavy lifting for you, because that's what it is. You know, when I was reading this section, I kind of felt for these men in a way I don't usually. I felt like they're in a pickle. You know, this works, so they know that, but it's not really 100% okay. And there's women doing it, and that's not 100% okay. And they're not doing it, and that's not 100% okay. But it's still happening.
The thing that was so difficult about that chapter was just there's so much contradiction. There's so much instability. There are assertions that yes, of course, soothing words and the passions of the soul and prayers and charms and amulets. Yes, of course, these are viable modes of health, but don't trust women with them. Only knowledgeable men know how to use them correctly.
But maybe women will be administering them.
Yeah.
Right?
You should be very suspicious because women are most likely to be using them.
Mm-hmm. And women,
they also really want to be careful about, there are women that are truly holy that can't, they're limbed by so many different factors.
And, you've got this space where, like, prayer works. And that's – and an incantation is just kind of a variety thereof, right? Of, like, verbal, like, a magic – God-approved, not magic, but, this thing, this supernatural power. But it's really close to prayer, too, which is definitely – women can pray, but they can't pray for – like, it's –
right.
They don't have that spiritual authority. This is a really tough path to chart. You are a little bit free of that, much free of that when we move into part three. And that's just the communication that women basically had with one another.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So part three goes into a new kind of text. And so part three basically says, all right. So... So, if you look at something like Danielle Jacquard's study, amazingly thorough study of practitioners, then we find 1.5% of the total number of practitioners in the Kingdom of France from the 12th to 15th century are women, 1.5%. And yet we look at something like these hagiographic sources, and it, even though I use hagiographic sources, we're not limited to those. I mean, if you look at things like romance and poetry, women are constantly appearing, surfacing as, you know, using potions and using herbs and healing, you know, fallen knights and all kinds of things. So it's this sort of, okay, sure, we do not see women writing systematic medical treatises. And we don't find that Monica Green has done an incredible study of the manuscripts and shown that, you know, when we look at women's communities, we also don't see academic medical treatises. And yet, nevertheless, we know from the number of hospitals that women ran. We know from records like these hagiographic sources that women, we know from anthropological studies that women are still providing the bulk of care. So for section three, I was just sort of like, okay, well, what do we have? What were women reading? You know, if they weren't reading academic treatises, well, how were they gaining knowledge about the body and health? So for that section, then I look at the kinds of sources that women did have in their communities. And that is, that section is divided into two different chapters. One is on psalters as a genre of book that circulated through women's communities, and specifically through women's communities that we know for a fact ran hospitals.
Real quick, what's a psalter?
Oh, yes, of course. That's not knowledge you're born with. That's not intuitive. So a psalter is, it's essentially a prayer book. It's a book of psalms. And technically, the books that I look at would be called psalter hours, which is, so they're the psalters, so the book of psalms, this central book in both Jewish and Christian tradition, a biblical book. And then also the Psalter Hours is more a better terminology for the kind of book that I use. So it's not just the Psalter, that is, it's not just the course of Psalms. It's also, there are daily prayers, there are prayers, there are sort of specific prayers for specific times, but there are also, the reason I chose the specific manuscripts that I chose was there are also a number of incidental texts, a number of texts that were inserted into what could be, what one might regard as a sort of a formulaic prayer book, mm-hmm. The Psalter Hours might be seen as otherwise formulaic. What we have among the Judith Oliver collected 41, noted a collection of 41 psalters from beginish, I'll say, communities, Beguin and Beguin-like communities in the southern Low Countries, around the Meuse Valley, this river valley. They all sort of have sort of improvisational texts. So in addition to the formulaic, the standard Psalter, the standard Psalms and prayers, there's also more individualized components as well, individualized readings. And those tell us a lot about how women were using these books. They allow us to kind of make some movement beyond the traditional liturgical use of a book to think about it, to think about this book guiding women's knowledge and guiding women's action in other terrains as well, outside of just the standard liturgy. So on the one hand, I look at Psalters, and mm-hmm. Psalters have the Psalms, but they also include things like poetry and regimen and liturgy and saints' prayers. And then in the other section, I look at miscellanies, what we might call devotional, a couple of devotional miscellanies from the 13th century, from women's communities, and to think about how women were, well, the 13th and early 14th century, I should say. But these include things like birth indulgences, prayers, very explicit healing prayers to saints. They include performative texts like blessings of water, for example, blessings for grain. And they also, the range of texts in these miscellanies are just there's a great number of many different kinds of texts in these books. And they sort of allow me to imagine how saints' lives were read in religious communities, in women's religious communities. And they were read as therapeutic. So it kind of goes full circle. It goes back to the original hagiographic sources that I talked about in the first section, and thinking about how those sources themselves were read as a means of stimulating the passions of the soul, mm-hmm. as a means of healing. I think the big thing I would also just say about the kinds of sources that I look in this last section is that there's this idea of orature, which I learned from Ngugi wa Thiong'o. And orature refers to the sort of this space between text and performance, or written text and oral knowledge or orally communicated ideas. And so getting back to the question about non-evidence, why women's communities, religious communities, don't have medical texts in them, why we don't see these academic treatises in women's hands. Well, it seems from the text that we do have that medical knowledge, humoral medical knowledge, was communicated not through in women's communities, was communicated not through these systematic treatises, but through orature, through oral performance, that knowledge about the body and health and healing was transmitted in women's communities in this space between the written and the oral. Through media like poetry and images.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, did they see themselves as healers?
That's a great question. I don't know how to answer that question. That's a really good question. In part, I don't know how to answer that question because in a large part, we just don't have their own writing. But I think that... they would have seen themselves as sort of caretakers, as doing charitable service. And does that mean healing? Yes. I think their audiences, their patients saw them as healers for sure. I think they saw their work, the best way that I can encapsulate how I think they regarded their own labor as the labor of charity.
So do you see them as healers?
Yeah, absolutely. I do. Yeah. I see them as healthcare workers. And I see them as doing the kind of the healthcare work that they do is the most intimate and daily and sustaining work that there was.
I mean, I think part of the thing that I see here as well is that you're kind of forcing us to reconsider what falls under the purview of pre-modern medicine. And I've been, look, we have these boundaries for what equals medicine, and they may not map specifically here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that we are so conditioned in the we that I'm weeing here is, you know, I'm talking to you from the United States in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And so it's very hard to unthink biomedicine. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we tend to project our understanding of biomedicine onto the pre-modern past. And so a big goal of this book for me was to unthink bio in biomedical terms. And instead of looking at what those with authority say this is medicine, instead looking at acts of healthcare. Mm-hmm. So looking at practice, looking at going to the sites where people said I was healed, or the sites where people said I am sick and I want assistance. And those sites were very different from Montpellier, you know, those sites from Bologna. Those were much more intimate settings. Those were bedsides. Those were tombs and shrines and relics. And so that tells me simply that our biomedical modes of thinking about what is medicine simply can't capture, and they obscure what the ways that people living in late medieval Europe sought to access healthcare.
Yeah, definitely. And then, of course, that's gendered, right? As Mary Fazell noted, and you mentioned in your book, almost everyone, this is not a quote, it's a paraphrase, like basically almost everyone is brought into the world and ushered out of it by a woman. So it's hard not to think about that. And,
definitely. It's a very gendered division of labor.
and thus the care of those people in between those two moments, is also going to be gendered, going to be gendered female.
Yes, absolutely. Montserrat Cabré, just like so many of the other scholars I've mentioned, are just absolutely brilliant, wonderful scholar, really blew the lid off with her observation that women didn't receive occupational markers, meaning they didn't get professional titles. You're not going to find women as healthcare workers by going around and looking for terminology like doctor or physician or surgeon, or even in many cases, midwife. Instead, you have to look for the kind of healing and healthcare acts. And when we're talking about medieval medicine, healthcare acts are preventative health. Regimen, eating good food, having a clean environment, making sure you get fresh air and exercise. That's women's work.
Yeah. Wow. Wonderful. I was really impressed by these women. I mean, like I felt this like reverence and fondness for them. I imagine you did as well.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, They are wild and wacky and fascinating. And yeah. I mean, for me, they are, you know, we use today, especially now, the language of essential worker and, you know, like frontline workers, sorry. And that's what they're doing. They're essential. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about your afterword and your search for a place to end the book.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I need to ask a question after that. I think you can just go from there.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't end it. I couldn't finish it. So the only reason that I was really able to end it was I would say two things. One is I had to be incredibly precise and incredibly limited on the one hand, because if you start using these kinds of methods, you know, non-evidence, for example, you'll never not find things. I just kept Lucy Barnhouse published this really great article in Medieval Feminist Forum, right as I was trying to finish. And she's like basically seeing very similar patterns in Germany. And I was like, oh my gosh, do I need to, do I need to stretch into Germany? Do I need to go into Italy? No.
No. No, you don't.
Yes, exactly. So one of the other things is my lovely editor at Cornell, Mahinder Kingra, was like, you're going to get questions about witches. I want to say something about the witches. And so trying to end it it felt futile, because it's a pattern that sustains, if we think about submerged knowledge, and if we think about the gender division of labor, and frankly, the raced division of labor, mm-hmm. We're constantly going to be coming up against this problem of submerged knowledge, this problem of authority refusing to recognize, to give place in the archive to the sort of daily sustaining acts that I was searching after. And so, yeah, the afterword just, it tries to chronicle that, that constancy. And so I look at an example of a report from a Beguine, the 19th century, where we see the exact same pattern, where basically the care that she sort of engineers and her network engineers, the kinds of therapeutic tools they develop, it becomes a miracle. It's sort of translated as, oh, Mary's intervention, or no, it's actually not Mary's intervention. Philomena's miraculous intervention. I look at, closer to home. Well, what was my home for mm-hmm. my life?
Yeah.
A similar miracle in South Louisiana. And, it feels like this sort of a current that won't really end the way.
Sure. Well, I mean, you do, right. You start in Ghent in 1840, and then it's 1870, and we're in Louisiana, and then we're back in the 14th century. And it's just back and forth, the dialectic between women caring for their patients, the ability of women to care for their patients, the constant attempt by men of authority to limit it. I mean, yeah. How do you end that story?
Yeah, because
we're still in it. But it was a valiant, good effort, and it felt like a conclusion. I was not dissatisfied. I didn't finish, and it was like, well, it wasn't like the I was just waiting for a sequel. So,
well, there's a sequel.
All right. Well, here's my next question. What are you working on now?
Oh, okay. There you go. So one of the things about this book that just grabbed me by the shoulders and shook me into a new way of thinking was ideas about performance as a mode of cultural transmission. So I've been developing a project that traces forms of the French pre-modern that sort of flicker throughout the Atlantic world, really. I really want to break with, I've been writing, in a very traditional academic mode with the academic monograph. And I want to break away from that as much as possible. And performance as an analytical lens allows that. I also really want to question my own position in a more sort of upfront, invisible way, where I came from and how my own family history has shaped the way I have seen the medieval past. It becomes, you know, especially with Acts of Care, when we end in Louisiana, I mean, it's clear to me that the way that I see the medieval world is very much filtered by my own cultural context. And so, you know, there are models like Kendra Field, for example, has written a wonderful book that uses her own position, her own family history to think about migrations. And so that's kind of become a model. Sarah Knott, I think, is another example. Her book, I think it's called Mother is a Verb, really breaks with academic modes or the academic monograph to think about how to assemble fragments and personal experience into longer, deeper histories. And so what I want to do is, like I said, I'm interested in sort of tracing these modes of performance in the French pre-modern that flicker in the Francophone world, particularly in South Louisiana and the Caribbean. So things like carnival festivities, mortuary rituals, the Cajun and Creole ballads that I grew up with, which are all about St. Barbara. And, you know, like they're all very, very medieval. And they exist today because of the mixing, the hybridity, the mixing with indigenous traditions, with African Senegambian traditions and practices and knowledge. And so all I really know is that I'm still working on performance traditions. I'm thinking about them from my own positionality, my own perspective. And I'm really trying to challenge simple notions of the pastness of the medieval past and to sort of dismantle schemes of periodization that make the medieval inaccessible, otherworldly, and I want to insist on access. It's been hard writing in our current situation.
Yeah.
But hopefully that'll get off the ground soon.
That's intriguing. That sounds great. Tracing these threads as they go through. That sounds like this could just be me, but it seems like that it's going to lend to a very gendered analysis as well.
I think you're right.
There's going to be a lot of gender there. That sounds great. Wow. Thanks so much, Sarah. What a great time.
Oh, goodness. Thank you so much. I hope that one day we bust out of isolation mode and I can talk with you in person. But I've been enjoying my coffee while talking to you over my computer screen.
Yeah, this has been great. I think a glass of wine and or Belgian beer is probably a better choice. Well, the next time you make it over, you know, I'm just sitting here in Amsterdam waiting for people to visit me again.
Oh, gosh, I bet.
Also, I would like to go home or anywhere else. Yeah. It's a very small country to be kind of quarantined to. But no complaints.
Well, at least you've got that great beer.
That's very true. That is the truth. And all the French fries I can eat. So, you know. All right. Thanks so much for your time. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.